TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Arne Gundersen, What Did They Know? When Did They Know It? On the fifth anniversary of the Fukushima disaster, the new Japanese state secrets law, enacted in 2014, limits information and threatens journalists with jail time. And even Western media make it appear as if the worst has passed. Acknowledging the reality of this accident with global consequences at least 100 years into the future is not only frightening for just plain folk, but economically devastating to the energy corporations. When former nuclear engineer Arne Gundersen was asked by his family in early 2011 where the next nuclear power plant accident would take place, he said he was unable to say where, but that he was convinced that it would be a Mark I or Mark II General Electric design. 3 weeks later, the Fukushima Daiichi Mark I reactors melted down. Almost a quarter of the so-called fleet of nuclear reactors in the U.S. are of that same design as Fukushima Daiichi. If you live in New York City, Boston, Minneapolis, Detroit, Philadelphia, Chicago, or Wilmington, you are threatened by one or more of these vulnerable Mark 1 or 2 reactors. Only one of them was closed since Fukushima. The Vermont Yankee was shut down on December 29, 2014. The reason Arne Gundersen is so familiar with this design is that he was an engineer on the Millstone Mark 1 reactor and a nuclear insider until he was fired in 1990. For pointing out security flaws. Today he publishes on the website fairwinds.org. Here's a speech he gave at the Fukushima Symposium 2013 that is as brilliantly up to date today as it was then. Arne Gundersen, What Did They Know? When Did They Know It? He and his website Fairwinds became well known and respected after the Fukushima accident, for his often weekly updated reports. He continues to fill the void left by the unwillingness of TEPCO, the operator of Fukushima Daiichi, and the Japanese government to disclose full details of the accident and the cleanup. Gundersen holds an MA in nuclear engineering and once worked for the nuclear industry. He was an expert witness on the Three Mile Island partial meltdown and, more recently, on the serious safety risks at the Vermont Yankee and California San Onofre reactors. While Arne Gundersen, almost 50 years ago, was working on the General Electric Mark I type boiling water reactor Millstone near Waterford, Connecticut, plans were finalized about the construction of the almost identical first nuclear reactor for Fukushima. And as you will hear now, Gundersen argues that the 2011 Fukushima Daiichi accident in Japan began then and there in 1965 inside the U.S. on the drawing boards of the engineers in New York City who designed the site plan and architecture for the Mark I reactor at Fukushima. Gundersen also points the finger at the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission that permitted a flawed design to be licensed and built. Here is Arne Gundersen.
The Fukushima Daiichi accident was made in America. The reactor was designed by General Electric and built by a company called Evasco. I used to go to the Evasco offices right here in Manhattan when I was an engineer on Millstone Unit 1, which was almost identical to Fukushima Daiichi Unit 1. It was licensed by the Atomic Energy Commission, which at the time, in the 1960s, was the ultimate authority on nuclear licensing in the world. At least we thought that to be the case. This is not just a Daiichi issue. There's 22 other plants in the United States that are similar. And the plants in the United States are in some ways much worse because there's a lot more waste fuel in their spent fuel pools than there were at Daiichi. The engineers at General Electric and at Ebasco made six critical mistakes in 1965 that were to doom Japan in 2011. The first five critical mistakes all revolve around the issue of not really understanding the power of a tsunami. They reduced the height of the cliff that the plant was built on. They built a short tsunami wall. The diesels were placed in the basement. The emergency pumps, called the service water pumps, were placed in a situation where they were underwater. And finally, the diesel tanks were placed in a place where they, too, were flooded. These were engineers based here in New York City that simply didn't understand the power of a tsunami. The last issue on the Mark I containment is a little broader, and I'll get onto that as well. The cliff at Fukushima Daiichi in 1960 was 35 meters high, about 115 feet high. The engineers at GE and Ebasco cut it down to 10 meters, so it was a 30-foot cliff. Well, tsunami is a Japanese word coming from tsu, meaning harbor, and nami, meaning waves. The entire ocean rises up. If you're on a boat, you don't notice a tsunami because the entire ocean rises up, except when it hits a harbor, and then it becomes terrifying. It travels at close to the speed of sound. Engineers knew of tsunamis, and I thought I'd just go back 100 years in Japanese history to look at Pacific Coast tsunamis that hit Japan. In 1896, there was a 40-meter tsunami. 1923, there was a 13-meter tsunami. 1933, there was a 28-meter tsunami. And this was the tsunami of record as far as killing people before the Daiichi tsunami. 1944, there was a 12-meter tsunami. 46, another 12-meter tsunami. In 54 and 55, 10 years before Fukushima Daiichi was designed, there were three tsunamis, and all of them were over 13 meters. The tsunami that hit Fukushima Daiichi in 2011 was just a middle-of-the-road tsunami compared to the 100-year history before it. But in face of that history, the tsunami wall was built by American engineers at 4 meters and later raised to 5.7 meters. In addition, the diesels were placed in the basement. Now, diesels can be placed in the basement, but you should be able to put them in some sort of a waterproof container, which did not occur. It's important to know that General Electric built these first dozen or so Mark I reactors on what's called a turnkey contract. They took $60 million and built these plants, and they lost their shirt. I know because I worked on one of these turnkey reactors, Millstone 1, around the same time. So there was a lot of economic pressures on General Electric to keep the cost down because they were losing money dramatically on the dozen reactors they had built on this turnkey process. In addition, the service water pumps had to be at the water, but they were designed so that in any tsunami they would have been flooded. So it doesn't matter that the diesels were in the basement. If the diesels had been on top of the Empire State Building, we'd have the same problem because the cooling pumps that cool the diesels would have been flooded. In addition, the fuel tanks that provide fuel for the diesels were also in the floodplain. So again, it's not about the diesels being flooded. It's about engineers here in New York City, General Electric engineers and Ebasco engineers who didn't appreciate the magnitude of a tsunami. Now, there's some political issues going on as well. General Electric, whose motto, by the way, in 1960 was "Progress is our most important product," said in 1961, they said, "We're going to ram this nuclear thing through." Their chairman is quoted as saying that. And ram it through they did. They met with the Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards, which in theory is an independent body designed to protect Americans in this case, but those design decisions were driven into the Japanese design as well. And Dr. David Ockert, who was on the advisory committee, basically said that General Electric threatened them going out of business unless the advisory committee continued with this Mark I design. Scientists in the United States, 1965, recognized that this Mark I design had flaws. And as Dr. Ockert said, I think it was kind of a threat. Now, Glenn Seaborg was the chairman of the advisory committee at that time, and he actually has an atom named after him. He's got an element, a seaborgium, named after him. This is a heavy hitter in the nuclear industry. And he said, I don't think we had the power to stop them. Now, think about that. This is the United States government didn't have the power to stop General Electric's faulty design in 1966. Just about the time the Daiichi units were starting up in 72, there's a famous letter exchange with a senior scientist at General Electric named Joseph Hendry. And Mr. Hendry said that he had serious doubts about the Daiichi design, the Mark I containment. But as I've highlighted at the end, he said that he felt they should be eliminated. But in eliminating this Mark I design, quote, it could well mean the end of nuclear power, creating more turmoil than I could stand. So the turmoil he chose to avoid in 1972 became the turmoil that Fukushima Daiichi experienced 40 years later. So when this plant started up, a Made in America design, all of the critical problems that Daiichi was to face 40 years later were in place. Essentially, the fuse was lit on Fukushima Daiichi in 1970, and it exploded in 2011.
That was Arne Gundersen, nuclear engineer and head of Fairwinds Associates. He gives regular updates on Fukushima Daiichi. Gundersen spoke in New York City on March 11, 2013, at a two-day symposium on the second anniversary of the accident. All six reactors at Fukushima Daiichi are of the dangerous Mark I or Mark II design developed by General Electric. General Electric and Ibasco are responsible for the reactors and the architectural design of Units 1, 2, and 6. Toshiba or Hitachi are responsible for Units 3, 4, and 5. As he continues with his talk, Arne Gundersen describes how the earthquake and tsunami affected the six reactor units. One by one, he goes through some of the assumptions at the basis of the permit process for nuclear power plants. Given that so many experts in the late 60s and early 70s warned that the design of the General Electric Mark I and II was unsafe, regulators made specific assumptions that certain incidents were just never going to happen. Please bear with some of the technical detail. Almost a quarter of the so-called fleet of nuclear reactors in the U.S. are of that same design as Fukushima Daiichi. You do not have to fear a tsunami, but the loss of off-site power, possibly the most serious danger to any nuclear power plant, can also be caused by wind or ice storms, and they are becoming increasingly frequent. When heavy winter storms hit New England in early February 2013, the Pilgrim nuclear power station in Plymouth, Mass., lost outside power for several days. Pilgrim is a General Electric Mark I design. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the nuclear industry claim to have learned from the Fukushima accident. Far from considering shutting down all Mark I and II nuclear power plants, they are now fighting over whether the industry may be asked to put filters on the vents of the containments. As you may remember, at Fukushima Daiichi, the vents were opened to release huge amounts of hydrogen and radioactive gases into the environment to prevent, in vain, as it became obvious, explosions of the reactor containments. The largest nuclear power company in the U.S., Exelon, say that the $20 to $25 million for filters per unit is too much to pay. Marketplace reported the story on February 21, 2013. They said, without the filters, those vents might become a kind of radioactive fire hose, spewing radiation into the air. Now, in 2016, the filters still have not been added. And the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission voted 3-1 in August 2015 not to allow public comment or to go forward with proposed rulemaking and safety retrofits to all General Electric Mark I and II boiling water reactors in the U.S. We may have to wait till 2019 to see any results. Here's part two of the presentation by Arne Gundersen.
If we fast forward 40 years, this is the completed site right before the accident. The earth sunk a meter, 3 feet, after the earthquake. The tsunami was 15 meters high. But remember, it's moving at the speed of sound, so the wave, when it hit the plant, actually crested at 46 meters high, over top of all these buildings. So how bad was it? When we're evaluating the dose consequences of Fukushima Daiichi, the secret is in the assumptions, which is where I'll spend the rest of this presentation. Assumption one is that containments maintain their integrity. After all, they are called containments for a reason. They're meant to contain. No containment in the world is designed to handle a detonation shockwave. That's a shockwave that travels faster than the speed of sound. There's 440 nuclear reactors, and none of them can handle a detonation shockwave because engineers believed that it couldn't happen. Well, right after it did happen, it's interesting that the NRC's own Chuck Castle, now he's a senior guy, he's in charge of the NRC's Region 3 out of their Chicago office. A very senior guy at the NRC said this, of course, that Mark I containment is the worst containment we have. And if you have something called a loss of offsite power or station backout, you are going to lose the containment. There's no doubt about it. So remember that Mr. Hendry at the NRC in 1972 said this was the worst containment in the world. And here's the Nuclear Regulatory Commission saying the same thing immediately after the accident. We've known for 40 years that this Mark I design, like at Daiichi, was an accident waiting to happen. And of course, you've all seen the devastation that a detonation shockwave can occur. Containments were meant to contain, and this is not supposed to happen. Assumption number two is containment leakage. Now, what happened inside the Daiichi reactor was that the pressures got so high that the bolts that hold the containment together began to stretch. And hot radioactive gases and hot radioactive steam began to leak out, and hydrogen. Now, in addition to the hydrogen that was created in the fuel, there was already a meltdown in process, and that fuel was now lying up against concrete. The concrete was liberating hydrogen as well. So we had two sources of hydrogen after the Daiichi accident. The fuel, as it created something called the zirconium-water reaction, zirconium-water reaction. But we also had the meltdown was causing more hydrogen because the hot fuel was in contact with concrete, and that was liberating hydrogen as well. Now, the NRC assumes that containments leak at 1% a day. So in a room this size, what we're saying is that over 100 days, the gases in this room would leave and fresh gases would come in behind it. But what the NRC said in a phone call on March 23rd is that the reactors at Daiichi were leaking at 300% per day. That means that the gases inside Daiichi were leaving the containment every 8 hours. Whatever radiation was getting out of that nuclear fuel was being liberated to the environment within 8 hours because the containment leak rate was 300% per day, not 1% like the NRC assumes. Assumption number three is noble gases. Now, if you remember your high school chemistry, raise your hands if you do. I don't see many hands. Oh, I do. The far right of the periodic table is our noble gases, things like xenon and krypton. They're called noble because they don't react with anything. Nuclear fuel is loaded with noble gases, and as long as the fuel retains its integrity, the gases are trapped inside. Well, the fuel didn't retain its integrity, and all the noble gases were released. The data indicates that over Chiba, the xenon, which is a noble gas concentration, was 400,000 times normal immediately after the accident. And also that the concentration of xenon in Chiba was 1,300 becquerels per cubic meter for 8 days. Now, a cubic meter is about 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet. And think about it, inside every cubic meter of air over Chiba, there were 1,300 disintegrations emitting radioactivity every second for 8 days. What were those people breathing? Gases with noble gases, which can't be monitored now. They're gone. So I think one of the issues here is that the Japanese government has no idea how much exposure the people in Chiba got from this cloud of noble gases that were released. This is important data that just came out. Mainichi covered this story, but it's actually Fukushima Prefecture data, and it's only a couple of days old. There were four radiation detectors that continued to work after the Daiichi accident. Almost all of them didn't have power, but a couple were battery powered, and they just recently discovered the data. Normal background on these radiation detectors was about 0.04 microsieverts. At 5 o'clock in the morning, right after the accident, the radiation in the detectors was 10 times background. 6 o'clock, 60 times background. 9 o'clock, 150 times background. 10 o'clock, 700 times background. What that means is that somebody in the vicinity of these radiation detectors was getting a yearly dose in 12 hours. Then the vents were open. So this is a clear indication that the containments were leaking well before the vents were open. So at 3 o'clock, these same detectors were measuring 30,000 times background. That means a yearly dose in 10 minutes for the people in Chiba. Now, it's also important to realize this may not be the worst. This happens to be where the detector was. But it doesn't mean that the plume chose to go to the detector and get that reading. It's clear that this plume was meandering all over the western side of the plant and the northern side of the plant, even before the vents were open. Assumption number four, the decontamination factor for cesium, and I'm sorry, this is a little bit geeky, but the Nuclear Regulatory Commission assumes that after a nuclear accident, the water inside the torus, which is the donut at the bottom of the containment, takes out 99% of the cesium. That's called a decontamination factor of 100. That's actually written into law that they believe that to occur. But they also say that if the water hits boiling, there's no decontamination factor. The water is incapable of capturing any cesium. Well, the data from Fukushima shows that the water in that torus at the bottom of the containment did boil. Why did they boil? Because those cooling pumps I was telling you about that cool the diesel were also designed to cool the torus. So we had boiling water in the torus, and that meant that no cesium was retained. Now, the Japanese, as they're trying to reconstruct this accident, are claiming cesium was captured inside that torus, but the law and the data show that it couldn't be. Now, how do I know that? This is an important slide. It's an infrared image of Unit 3. The large blotch in the center of the screen is the spent fuel pool on Unit 3. And the temperature of the gases coming off the spent fuel pool are 62 degrees centigrade, which means that the fuel is boiling and it's mixing with cold air, and there's a bath of hot radioactive air over the fuel pool at 62 degrees. That's pretty bad. But what's worse is the flare that the drawing shows. Now, TEPCO's known about this for 2 years and has not talked about it. That flare is exactly where the containment should be. And that flare is at 128 degrees Celsius, which means it's not steam. Steam can't exist over 100 degrees. Engineers call this something in the steam tables. But at atmospheric pressure like we are today, when you boil steam, you're only going to get to 100 degrees centigrade. That flare is at 128 degrees, which means that it's not steam. It means it's hot, radioactive gases being released directly from the containment. It also means that inside the containment, it was not below the boiling point of water. It was above the boiling point of water. There was no liquid water inside that containment. This is on March 20th, 9 days after the accident. The containment is venting hot radioactive gases directly to the environment. This is proof positive in my view. And TEPCO, obviously, they're good engineers, and they would have seen that 128 degrees centigrade, about 250 degree hot radioactive flare being released in this infrared picture. So they've known for a long time that huge amounts of cesium were being released directly to the air because they weren't being trapped in the water in the suppression pool. And Prime Minister Khan said, our existence as a sovereign nation was at stake. So I think the point is, at what point do the risks of a technology become unacceptable? Well, my conclusion is that sooner or later, in any foolproof system, the fools are going to exceed the proofs. So, thank you.
That was Arne Gundersen. Gundersen holds an MA in nuclear engineering and once worked for the nuclear industry. He was recorded by Pacifica Radio at the Fukushima Symposium in New York City on the second anniversary of the nuclear disaster. The two-day event on March 11 and 12, 2013, was organized by the Helen Caldicott Foundation and co-sponsored by Physicians for Social Responsibility. Come back for two recent programs with Arne Gundersen, including an interview I did with him during his December 2015 speaking tour, and material from his always updated and referenced website, fairwinds.org. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening.